Yesterday, we talked about how the supposed shortage of scientists is a complete fallacy. And just to reiterate some of the main points, the 1957 study from the National Bureau of Economic Research showed that in the last 80 years, the number of chemists and engineers in the United States expanded by considerably more than 17 times as much as the total labor force. So just by the numbers alone, there wasn't a shortage. Another takeaway was that if there is an actual demand for more scientists, meaning there isn't an oversupply already, then wages would be rising. But instead, Murray noted that, quote, the same study showed that since 1939, salaries of engineers relative to earnings of doctors, dentists, and lawyers have declined. And it's hard to forget that, even though there were a ton of hiring engineers ads in the papers, 9/10 of those were government defense contracting ads. This hardly resembles actual market demand. Well, today we're going to discuss chapter 4, and the episode following this will cover the rest of the chapters, which are shorter but are extremely fun to discuss, things like Soviet science, automation, etc. So here we go. Now, in chapter 4, which is titled The Alleged Scarcity of Scientific Research, Murray destroys that claim with an abundance of facts. He starts off by discussing the space race. For example, the National Science Foundation has estimated that the Soviet Union has been putting a little over 1% of its national product into R&D. And to clear up why that's important is because the argument went that we needed to quote unquote redouble our efforts to beat the Soviets in the space race, yet we were already spending 2% or double that of their national product. Now, quoting from the book, in 1953 to 54, private sources contributed 2.6 billion to R&D. This contrasts to a total of 530 million of private funds in 1941. So this idea that without the government using taxpayer money to fund things like NASA, that said organizations wouldn't exist, it does not add up to the numbers. Even David Sarnoff, who was the board chairman of the RCA at the time, said, today, science and industry are linked by arteries of progress and their lifeblood is technical research. The pattern of our industrial progress lies in a partnership between those who created good things and those who produce and distribute and service them. It lies in teamwork between research and industry. So in effect, this goes back to what I said last episode about how there are no real shortages in a free market. From any perspective, a shortage would simply be an opportunity people would rush to quickly. Another quote by David Sarnoff, which I love, is, government control of research would destroy the very qualities that enable researchers to make such an important contribution to society. For government control means that rigid lines would be set for research, and these lines may not meet changing requirements. Certainly, industry is best qualified to define its own research needs, and the partnership between research and industry loses its meaning when government can dictate the subject and objective of research in any competitive system of private enterprise. Now, here's where it really gets interesting. The 1958 paper titled The Sources of Inventions was an examination of how the inventions we came to know at that time came about. And of course, the important question is, did they come about through governmental means or through the free market? Well, taking 61 of the most important inventions of the 20th century, it was found that more than half of these were the work of individual inventors with, quote, the individuals working at their own directions and with very limited resources. Inventions such as the air conditioner, automatic transmission, the Bakelite, the ballpoint pen, the catalytic cracking of petroleum, cellophane, the cotton picker, the gyro compass was invented by a young German art historian. The bulk of the basic inventions for radio came from individual inventors unconnected with communication firms. Penicillin was invented and partly developed in a university laboratory, and insulin was invented by a general practitioner who used a university laboratory. And for like two or three pages, he's just listing examples. And this is how in-depth of a scholar Murray really was. And if you read his work, most of it tends to read like this, just a plethora of facts. But continuing on, he provides this one quote by P.T. Farnsworth, who some may remember as being a great television pioneer. And it goes, the salient feature of my career is that my work has been almost wholly individual. My scientific and technical work has been almost wholly individual. And you got to remember, he ran the Farnsworth Television Radio Corporation from 1938 to 1951. And related to all this, what is it that truly cripples innovation? Well, government. From the study of the sources of innovation, which I mentioned before, another insight was that the chances of success are further reduced where the research group is organized in a hierarchical fashion, with ideas and instructions flowing downwards and not upwards, where the direction is closely defined, where men are asked to report at regular intervals, where achievements are constantly being recorded and assessed, where spurious cooperation is enforced by time-wasting committees and paperwork. And I'm sure many of us have experienced the inefficiency of this in our own lives. The DMV is an overused example, but really think about it. Your ability to live your life is in their hands. And not only is inefficiency hindered from top-down bureaucracy, but you usually are able to feel the resentment that these government workers have toward us normies, so to speak. I mean, see, they have it in their mind that government gives us rights, when in reality, our rights predate government's. All the state can do as a best attempt is to protect our rights, but clearly, they have a poor track record for that. So what makes anyone think that they can promote innovation? By default, they can't. They can only stifle innovation. Now, one distinction Murray makes, and it's important to make, is that not every industry had research and development, most notably manufacturing firms who, quote, the great bulk do not engage in R&D at all. The one-tenth that do are mostly in technologically advanced and advancing industries where scientific knowledge is needed and where scientists must be hired anyway for tests and control work. And he points out that few of the Nobel Prize winners since 1900 came from large industrial research laboratories. Furthermore, many of the current research labs of the big corporations originated as small firms where later they were bought by big corporations. This happened with General Motors and with General Electric, but with these larger firms who often are receivers of government protections, they don't have the same incentives. For example, quote, the telephone, cable, and electric manufacturing companies were originally apathetic about the possibilities of wireless telegraphy. RCA resisted Armstrong's FM ideas. The Edison Company at the turn of the century scoffed at the idea of a gas motor for transportation, insisting on the future of the electric motor for that purpose. And funny enough, even today, there's still a battle to move to electric cars, and they've come a long way, but this was over half a century ago. Well, that about covers it, but the chapter does end with an interesting point that is often lost among the talk of modern science. Real science involves testing, retesting, and the independent corroboration of facts by other individuals. Professor Baker, who had a piece titled Science in the Planned State, said that there is one occurrence which helps the scientists form a valid judgment better than anything else. This is the publication of the same result by two entirely independent workers. Central planners are inclined to consider that one of the two independent workers has been wasting his time. The actual research worker knows that this is not so. Is it the very fact that the two workers are independent that inclines other workers to accept their findings? Scarcely, a working scientist will deny that two independent papers containing the same result are very much more convincing than a single paper by two collaborators. You won't want to miss episode 25, which will cover the rest of the book. What was the deal with Soviet science? How inefficient exactly is governmental research? And atomic energy, automation? You won't want to miss it. This is Stephen Clyde, as always, for Peace and Liberty. Hey everyone, please like, follow, donate, subscribe, and share. Any donations will be used to reach more people.